bill up. Senator Stump, Senate File 3334.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This proposal was at the request of the City of Thief River Falls and the Pennington County. And it relates to allowing the Thief River Falls Airport Authority, which is currently under the city, to levy on the referendum market value of the county versus the adjusted net tax capacity. And the reason that I believe there's also a handout that was given to each of you requesting this or giving you some information. The reason for this is that the airport, the City of Thief River Falls has a relatively small tax base, and the airport is really a regional airport that benefits a much broader area than just the City of Thief River Falls. Give you an example, the bigger businesses up there that have that use the airport quite a bit, the biggest one is DigiKey, and they actually fly an enormous amount of freight in and out of Thief River Falls. And they have employees. Right now, I think it's probably about 2,300, and they're hiring about 400 more. And so those people come from a very large area, but to a large extent, DigiKey's success is based on the ability to fly that freight out of Thief River Falls, and most of it, a lot of it, I should say, goes on UPS, and then that goes right down to Nashville and then gets distributed worldwide. FedEx and some of the other carriers also fly freight out of there. But it's also used by a host of other companies, Arctic Cat, Madtrax, which is a company up in Greenbush, Central Boiler, Marvin Windows, and Polaris, which are all up in that area. So what the city and the county have done, they've gotten together, and they'd like to have a little bit broader tax base so they can keep the maintenance of that airport up. And they feel that with the pressure of the removal of the limited market value last year, which created a shift over onto farmland, that the best way to achieve this would be to use the referendum market value versus the net tax capacity. There's one other entity that uses the airport, quite a bit, because they actually have a campus. It's the Northland Community and Technical College. It's the aviation program, and it's the only aviation program left in the state of Minnesota. At one time, we had, I think, five aviation programs. This one is the only one that's left. And they just have received a $5 million grant to expand that aviation program to include the unmanned vehicles. They have a contractual agreement with UND over in Grand Forks, and UND basically has the training center for pilots and for... they also have a weather, they also have a controller training program. Thief River Falls basically does the maintenance of training of the maintenance professionals, so that they've gotten together and they are going to be training the maintenance of the unmanned vehicles. These are used extensively over in the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, and use them in many other places. They patrol the borders in both Mexico and Canada. And so each one of those unmanned vehicles has a whole team that goes with it to maintain the aircrafts. So that's basically the request. The mayor of Thief River Falls and the chair of the Pennington County Board sent us this letter, and I visited with the chair and the mayor, and they would like to move forward. There's some general basic maintenance that should be done at the airport, and the city has, like I say, the city's tax capacity is not very large, and they feel that they just can't continue to maintain that airport the way it should be maintained unless they have some additional resources. I think the total request is that they would look at would be somewhere around $150,000 to $200,000 a year. I'd try to answer any questions if anyone has.
So, something. Senator Stump, the effect of this would be to exempt ag land and exempt seasonal recreational property from the airport levy. Is that kind of the practical effect of it? And reduce the burden on businesses. Is that kind of the practical effect?
Well, I think the practical effect, you're correct. In that area, there's very little seasonal rec. It's all primarily ag land. And if you look at Pennington County is a very small county to begin with. It basically just has three cities. Goodrich, which is about 98, maybe it's 198, but St. Hilaire, which is kind of on the other side, which is very, very small, and then, of course, Thief River Falls. So it basically is extending out the ability to spread that taxing authority onto a little larger base than just the city of Thief River Falls.
I understand that, but if we exempt, I guess how much of Pennington County is ag property that would be exempted, and then doesn't that kind of raise the burden on the homeowners in the cities?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. That's what the the referendums and the schools do. I think the feeling on the part of the mayor and the chair or the city and the county officials is that ag land the last year has taken quite a hit, and there's a fairly significant increase that we had on our ag land this last year. In visiting with some farmers, and I know you have some farmers on your committee, the future right now doesn't look quite as bright as it did a few years ago. And so I think the feeling on the part of the city and the county is that the only way that they would, the best way for them to move forward would be this way versus assessing all properties.
Senator Stump, don't you think it's kind of a dangerous precedent? I mean, I can just see the cabin owner lobby, for example, I think they're in the room, would probably, in some of the areas that have a lot of seasonal rec, would probably like to be exempted from those regional airport levies where there is a lot of seasonal rec. So I just kind of wonder about the precedent of, and could create quite a bit of shifting in some areas of the state that have either a lot of ag or a lot of seasonal rec.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask Senator Stump? I don't know if you said anything about the bonding bill. Did the airport get? Did the governor approve that? I think we had it in our bill. I just was curious.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Scheid, yes, it did. Okay. So that was funded, and good. So the expansion of that hangar will occur. And interestingly enough, I didn't know it at the time, but. DigiKey just announced about, I think about a week ago, that they're hiring another 400 people. If you look in the papers up there, they are they constantly have ads seeking, you know, to hire people. Some of them are, you know, different for different jobs. So some of them are technical, some of them are not. But the fact that they're going to hire another 400 people, I think that'll probably push them up to. They were at a little over 2,000 or 2,100, and that'll push them well into, you know, 24, 25, maybe even more.
Good. Senator Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think that if the Senate had prevailed and removed seasonal rec from this, it would have been less of an issue, because the utilization of the airport is, you know, mostly the people and businesses in the county. I think the ag sector in Pennington County doesn't utilize the airport for any of their for their business practices. But being that seasonal rec is included, I think there would be shifting in other areas that you'd have to be concerned about. And, if it wasn't for the seasonal rec, I don't think it would be quite as much of an issue.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if Senator Stump mentioned it or not, but when the bonding committee was up there, they were wanting, I think it was 600 and some thousand for airport expansion, and in my bill it was 2,700,000. We were very, very impressed with the potential for new jobs, and what they had asked for was only going to last for about 5 years or so. So it was a bit unusual that we ended up giving about four times what they asked for.
Senator Lyons is very generous in his
It's very impressive.
And Senator Lyons, the governor signed that?
He did.
Yeah.
Any other questions, members? Chair Lee is over Senate file 3334 for possible inclusion. Senator Stump, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Here. Senator Roebling? Senator Roebling has Senate file 2448. Senator Roebling, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. What my bill does is it requests that when the property statements are mailed, that it provide that we have a little more transparency on them, and that we eliminate the other category that is currently included on the statements. And I received some complaints about this, and it piqued my own curiosity, and I looked at my own statement, and under other on my statement, it was $150. And I thought, what is this for? And I thought, well, part of it must be for the watershed district, but I wonder if that's all or if there's something else. And so I called my county auditor and asked her what the breakdown was, and it turned out on mine it was only two things. It was part of it was for the Community Development Authority, and the rest was for the Watershed District, which was the majority of it, actually. And so the issue, though, is just if you get a bill from anybody else, if you go to get your car repaired, and you get a $1,000 bill or a $2,000 bill, and there's a line on there that says other, wouldn't you be curious what they were charging you for? And no, you know, in the private sector, they just don't do that. They break down the bill so that you know what you're paying for. And I think it's especially important in a case like this because, you know, if you want to know that it's going to the watershed district, do you think you're getting your value for that? I mean, is that something that you think you should be paying that much for? And if you don't think that it's an appropriate amount, you should know who to go to complain about it or to talk about it. And so I guess that's what I'm really looking for, is just accountability and transparency. And I think these others have crept up since this has been in effect, the law that we have that allows them to be lumped together. And I have concern that, you know, it keeps getting bigger and bigger as the years go by. And we really should be giving taxpayers the information of what that is being paid for. And so that's really what I'm asking. I realize there's a few folks from the county here who want to make some comments on it. But I'm hoping that you'll consider this request, because I truly think that we should join the private sector on this and break down our bills a little more than we have been doing lately.
Senator Roebling, thank you. This must be a pretty good bill, because I say I'm an author on it.
Yes. I talked to you early in the session about it when I was getting it ready.
Mr. Chair.
Would anybody like to testify on the bill? I guess I'm a little interested in knowing what the counties think about. Can we still all fit it all on one statement if we go down this road, or is there some kind of a threshold we maybe can put on to limit the number of lines? But I think Senator Roebling generally has a good idea. A little more transparency is probably a good thing for the taxpayer, especially in the days of ever-rising property taxes. I think many of us have probably been getting phone calls in the last couple of weeks as statements came out.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Kevin Corbett, the Director of Property Records and Taxpayer Services for Washington County. I'm here today in my role as Legislative Chair for the County Auditors and Treasurers Association. We don't have a position in opposition or support of this, but just wanted to raise a couple thoughts. One, I would first suggest that I'm not sure the language of the bill does what Senator Roebling has suggested. It seems to me that what it does is it makes you split out the metropolitan special taxing districts, the Met Council, Met Mosquito, Metropolitan Airports Commission, because that's the special taxing districts that are defined in that subdivision. So I'm not sure that was the intent to what you're looking for. And it also deleted then separating the regional rail authorities, which I think was a law change a number of years ago. So I don't know if the intent is all of them, you might want to change that language so it's clear to the county auditors what we put on the statements. The second thing, question then, I guess, if we are going to go down the route of all the special taxing districts, that can be up to 9 or 10 different special taxing authorities in a particular city or county. And I think that then there does become a concern about space on a property tax statement. The statements are used for a couple different purposes. One, to get a bill to people, but we also use those statements as a vehicle to receive the taxes. And we oftentimes include stubs on the top or bottom of a statement so that we can collect it efficiently. And if you add more space to the amount of taxing districts you list, we could have some difficulty keeping it on a legal size paper, which could create some additional costs for printing, folding, all those kind of things when we put together our statements. The second item is, I think there's a little bit of a trade-off. You're going to get more information for taxpayers doing it this way, but there is some more proofing that needs to get done at the county level. When we group them together, we're proofing basically two lines on the statements, one for current year and one for previous year, these taxing districts. If you're trying to proof 10 different groups now, you've just got a little bit more work to do to make sure that that the statements reflect accurately what the system shows for taxes owed. So there are some concerns about time it would take us and potential costs, but I would suggest that this isn't the end of the world if this occurred, but just some additional administrative duties for the county auditors.
Senator Langstaff.
Mr. Chairman, beside other, you say turn to back page and on the back of it, just list the, maybe that would help a little bit.
How about an asterisk that refers you to another place or an attached sheet?
Mr. Chair, I brought my statement that I mailed to myself just the other day, and I was just going to turn the page and look at the back, but I suspect we probably could put that on the back. You know, currently we have information about the refund programs, the late penalty chart that show what your penalty if you pay late. There's a senior citizen deferral information on the back, but potentially we could list those special taxing districts. I would acknowledge that Senator Roebling is not the only one that gets questions. We also get questions that people call and say, what is other? And we explain to them that it's watershed and those kinds of things that occur. It's EDAs, it's potentially HRAs, it's regional development authorities, all those kind of things. So I acknowledge that there are some questions on this, and we do field calls
and we can fix that.
On these. But potentially the back could be a solution as well.
Any questions, members? Would anybody else like to testify on the bill?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
I'm certainly willing to work with them to see if we could figure out how that would be accomplished. And I just would like to ask Senate Council if the bill is doing what I was hoping it was doing and not just affecting the Metropolitan Council line.
Right. Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, I think the reference to a particular definition of taxing districts should be changed. It's currently the one that refers just to the metropolitan districts. We would just delete on lines 15 and 16 of page 1 the current statutory reference and insert 275066, and then that would bring in all of the special taxing districts.
Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if so, Roebling, maybe some differentiation between those that actually have independent levy authority versus those that are just passing along something that's been decided by somebody else. There may be some like that. Because what the taxpayer wants to know is, who do I call? Who made that decision? And there may be some differentiation there depending on the type of levy. I'm not sure. And then the other thought would be perhaps just itemize ones that there's a certain level of deviance from the previous year, which might be of interest to somebody. You know, if there's a 10% deviance from the previous year listed. If there isn't, whatever. Because sometimes too much information on the form makes it harder to read, too.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I mean, I think the interest isn't necessarily just for purposes of complaint here. It's the purpose, I think, of Senator Roebling's proposal is that we just know where the money's going. I mean, somebody may question, you know, some piece of that, the watershed or whatever, but it's just a matter of being open and, as you said, transparent about where the money's going. I don't know that it's necessarily for complaint. I called myself to complain about my seasonal rec property taxes the other day.
Did it work?
Mr. Corbett mailed his own statement to himself. Yeah, I'm not happy.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogemiller.
Senator Scheid, but some of these, don't you need to look at the context of, on your city levy, they don't break out police, fire.
Right.
They kind of say, who has authority for setting that levy?
Mm-hmm.
So that's all I was wondering. If there may be some things here that there's really no decision being made, it's kind of boilerplate or something that's been set by the legislature.
These are the special taxing districts, so they do.
I'm sure Mr. Corbett and the county folks can help think
about the ones referred to in there, yeah.
I think Senator Roebling was trying to get at.
That's what we fixed there.
She wants information
the new
on
reference in the bill.
It's useful
yeah.
to people.
The people that have levy authority.
Right.
Senator Pogemiller, council tells me that the way the bill is crafted, the only special levies that would show up are categories that have levy authority.
Independent authority.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
And that's as many as 12?
Okay.
Wow.
Mr. Chair, actually,
Senator Roebling.
In state law, there's 26 potential separate ones, but we've been told that no one property would ever have that many, that they could have as many as 8 to 10 would be about the maximum.
26.
In my case, other was only 2. It was just the watershed and the CDA. And so it can vary. You know, I did talk to my county auditor about grouping them potentially because you could put, you know, like regional housing or the HRA, the EDAs, the CDAs, you could have a line like that, I suppose. Port authorities would be included in that. Regional development commissions, perhaps. I'm not sure if they would be considered service groups or not, or EDA type. And then you could have one that would be services districts, which would be ambulance services, fire services, hospital services. And then also, let's see, it was economic development, and then watershed. Because everybody has one of those. Either you're in a watershed district or a WMO. And so, you know, there's a possibility we could break it down into categories. It wouldn't tell you directly which one you're paying it to, but you would at least have an idea of who it was going to. You know, my preference would be to give the complete breakdown, but I don't know if in some cases it gets to be 9 or 10 extra lines. It might, you know, it might pose a bit of a problem, but it's good information for taxpayers to have. And I don't know if it would be that burdensome or not, and we can continue to talk to them about it. And maybe if need be, we could cluster them somehow.
Any other questions, members? Senator Roebling, thank you. We'll do a little work on this and try to get the language cleaned up and figure out how we get something incorporated into the bill. So,
I appreciate that.
Chair lays over Senate File 2448 for inclusion.
Thank you.
Senator Roebling, thank you. Senator Berglund? Has Senate File 2338. Senator Berglund, we haven't had very many bills come to us this year that propose raising revenue, so we're excited to hear about what you're proposing because this committee, like most of them around here, are looking for some ways to raise a little cash.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this has been a very interesting bill for me to work on. It was brought to me by a constituent, and the bill, in addition to raising a little bit of revenue, has the potential for really changing behavior among the public in a way that will really help our environment and reduce the costs that we have at the local level for cleaning up our waste stream. And the bill itself imposes a 5-cent tax on the use of single-use bags. And it is something that has been implemented in Washington, D.C. As of January 1st of this year. And initially they saw a 50% reduction in the use of single-use bags. But now that it's been in effect for, 4 months, 5 months, it's 85% reduction in the use of single-use bags. So it's proving to be a very successful strategy for helping to clean up our environment. The bill itself gives 1 penny of the tax to the retailer for the trouble they take to collect the tax and to count when people are using the bags. If a retailer has a policy of giving a refund to consumers that use reusable bags, they get 2 cents of the revenue. And that's basically what the bill does. I do have some constituents. As I said, I have a constituent that brought the bill to me, and then I have someone also who's representing the Audubon Society who would like to testify. And rather than my going into all of the amounts of barrels of oil we use producing plastic bags just for use in the state of Minnesota and all of the ways that the bags pollute our environment, I will let them do that, Mr. Chairman, because they can speak as eloquently as I can about that. So why don't we take the witnesses?
Sure. Happy to. Who would like to testify on the bill?
Hi, my name is Andrew Johnson, and I am one of Senator Berglund's constituents. I'd like to thank the committee for the time today, as well as Senator Berglund for pursuing this bill, and my friends and family who are here to support me as well. This really started with the idea, if I had a nickel for every time a plastic bag was littered in the great state of Minnesota, I'd be very rich. In fact, the state would be very rich. We got our estimates back from the Minnesota Revenue Department, and it shows $19 million being returned to the general fund from this particular bill. The Natural Resources Defense Council calls plastic bags the most ubiquitous form of litter on this planet. Every year, the United States goes through more than 100 billion plastic bags, of which Minnesota uses 1.72 billion, which requires over 206,000 barrels of oil in order to produce those bags. Now, there are recycling programs for plastic bags in place today, but currently less than 10% of these plastic bags are recycled. Of the over 90% that aren't recycled, they either are put into the trash system, which contributes more than 50,000 tons of solid waste, or they become litter. And even a lot of trash becomes litter, which gives rise to the saying that you can tell when you're by a landfill by how many plastic bags you see lining the road. To make matters worse, these plastic bags don't biodegrade for thousands of years, if ever. And when they do, they break down into tiny particles that enter water streams and systems. In a study of the Anacostia Watershed District, 47% of trash in tributaries and 21% of the trash in rivers were plastic bags, making it the largest contributor to trash in the watershed district. And it's a cost, besides costing the environment, it's a cost we all pay. We pay as taxpayers to clean it up when these bags clog our storm water runoff systems. When they get stuck in grates, we pay through stormwater control maintenance costs as taxpayers. We pay as consumers at the registers. The price of these bags are built into all the products that we buy. And businesses pay for it. It's a major business expense. So this tax will help businesses by reducing expenses, will help the environment by reducing the litter, will help taxpayers by reducing the stormwater control maintenance costs as well. Some cities around the country and countries as well have banned these plastic bags. Currently, as Senator Berglund said, the city of Washington, D.C. has passed this. This has been in place. And in fact, yesterday, The Atlantic in their business section had an article titled, let's see what I got here, "Why D.C.'s Plastic Bag Tax Works So Well." It's just one of many. These articles are constantly coming out talking about how it's been such a great contributor to the revenue stream in D.C. through taxes, as well as how it's making a difference in terms of litter. In terms of other places doing something right now, China, Australia, France, Italy, South Africa, Bangladesh, and many other countries have just outright banned plastic bags. Ireland, Germany, Spain, Holland, Belgium, Switzerland, and many other countries have imposed a tax on plastic bags to reduce consumption. And currently, Virginia, Maryland, Texas, Washington, New York, and over a dozen other cities are currently debating or have passed plastic bag tax laws. San Francisco also did ban plastic bags in late 2007. So this really has a substantial difference on the environment. It has, obviously, during these tough economic times, a huge impact on the general fund in terms of revenue. It returns money to retailers for implementing the tax as well, and it's just good for everybody involved. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Good morning, Senator Bach and committee. My name is Sarah Risser, and I represent Audubon Society, Audubon, Minnesota. Audubon, Minnesota is one of the state offices of the National Audubon Society. We have over 10,000 members in Minnesota, and we are organized into 12 active chapters from Thief River Falls to Austin, Minnesota. So when I speak today, I'm really speaking for a broad section of Minnesotans. Associating a cost with new plastic and paper bags will encourage consumers to consider alternatives, such as bringing a reusable bag or, if their purchase is small, going without. This is important because the widespread use of disposable bags creates many problems and costs. One of the biggest concerns that's already been mentioned today is that plastic does not degrade, at least not readily, and certainly not in the short term. It takes thousands of years for plastic to begin to break down, and when it does, it fragments into tiny particles that inevitably end up in our food chain. Further, while plastic bags look benign, they are among the greatest causes of marine mortality. When plastic ends up in water bodies, it chokes, suffocates, and disables aquatic life, including ducks, fish, and turtles. Plastic bags have accumulated in our environment to such an extent that they are currently considered the most ubiquitous form of litter on the planet. They comprise the single largest component of trash in streams and rivers. According to a 2008 study of the Anacostia Watershed, also mentioned this morning already, pollution in plastic bags represented 47%, that's almost half of the trash. in tributaries and 21% of the trash in rivers. And I just wanted to mention a note I got from an Audubon Society member who lives near Rochester, Minnesota. She knew that I was interested in this issue, and she wrote to me saying, essentially, go, Sarah, this is such an important issue. We have plastic bags clinging to every corn stalk and fence post outside of Rochester. We really need to do something about this problem. As we know, the District of Columbia has had remarkable success with this tax, and it has generated considerable revenue. And I think what I want to emphasize is this really is it's not just a win-win, it's a win-win-win. It helps the environment. The way the bill is structured, it will help retailers cover their cost, and it's going to bolster state revenues. So if you take a step back and look at this bill, everybody benefits. In Minnesota, we use over 1.5 billion plastic bags annually. Apologies for being redundant, but again, that's the equivalent of over 200,000 barrels of oil. Minnesotans could benefit from a disposable bag tax that would generate revenue, and that revenue could be used for many things, including environmental cleanup programs for river and watershed pollution, possibly to fund environmental science programs. As mentioned, the legislation also provides an incentive to administer the program by allocating a penny of the tax to retailers. Thank you for allowing me to express Audubon Minnesota's strong support for this legislation.
Mr. Chairman, I know that every time I have helped present this bill in a committee, I've been asked, well, why would you include paper bags? So let's talk about that. Paper bags are biodegradable, but they actually take more energy to produce than the plastic bags do. And the goal of the bill really is to try to get people to reuse bags or to use cloth bags. And if you want to limit the bill to just plastic bags, that would be better than nothing. But we have a letter in the packet from SuperValue urging us to include both plastic and paper bags. They believe that having retailers just switch to using more paper bags would be more trouble for them than having it be a tax on all bags so that we would get people to use reusable bags. They're also, in your packet, we have received support from Eureka Recycling and the Natural Resources Defense Council, in addition to the Audubon Society and the League of Women Voters. Be ready for any questions.
So, Senator Berglund, if we took paper out,
well, you'd have a smaller fiscal note for sure.
The revenue estimate would go down by about 20%?
Mm-hmm.
Is that pretty close? I think.
Four
out of five are plastic currently. So.
Right, but I'm not sure if that takes into account the incentive people would have then to switch to paper bags rather than bringing a reusable bag.
If I could address that question as well. In states and cities that have done something similar to that, where they've just taxed plastic bags, people will switch over to the paper, and it will result in a 90% reduction in plastic use, or greater than. But I would see that as being a huge, it would take a huge cut out of this revenue. You'd be talking about maybe 10% the revenue numbers, potentially, of what we have here.
Mr. Johnson, what do you think about plastic water bottles?
Plastic water bottles, yes, I have one in front of me right now. I think, it's not a great thing either. So,
how about a couple pennies on those?
I would be fine with that, if that's the price that I have to pay. But, it really is something that it gets people thinking, and that's the huge success out of Washington, D.C., is because even though it's a small price to pay, I go to the grocery store and I spend $100 on groceries, I can fit them in two bags. So 10 cents on $100 is not a big price. But it's that fact that you're going from zero cost right now, even though the cost is still there, consumers are still paying it at the registers, businesses are still paying for it. So the cost is there, you just can't see it. But making people aware of that cost suddenly changes the way that they perceive the plastic bags. And right now, with each individual using an average of 344 plastic bags a year, it just makes sense. Next time you go to Blockbuster Video, you don't need them to throw your DVD into a plastic bag when you can just carry it out in your hand.
So, Mr.
Johnson,
Chairman,
I had Department of Revenue score plastic bottles last year. Tell me, and a penny on a plastic bottle makes this revenue estimate look small.
Certainly. Well, Mr. Chairman, of course, one of the things that we're trying to accomplish with the bill is not just raising revenue, but changing behavior that will have a big impact on our environment. I hope that you've all learned a lot about this issue today. I've learned a lot about the issue working on it, and I would like to thank Mr. Johnson, my constituent, for bringing this idea to us.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, since I first heard this, it's affected what I'm doing since
good.
I first heard the bill. So
yeah,
I appreciate it. And if they would get tap water to taste as good as bottled water, I'd drink more of it. But I haven't found the place yet that has that or as cold.
Senator Berglund, this morning when I put my recycling out before I came in the recycling container I had 3 grocery paper bags. What am I going to do if I don't have grocery paper bags anymore? What do people that don't have grocery paper bags do with their recycling? What do you put it in?
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid?
Mr. Chairman, and I see you have a note about Maple Groves. We don't have to sort our recycling in Brooklyn Park either. So you don't need paper bags to put it in your big container, your big plastic container. now that I think about it.
Could be wood. Senator Dibble.
Two tangential points. One is Senator Scheid, the water in Minneapolis actually beats the taste, except for when that algae bloom happens, but beats the taste tests of all the water, all the bottled water. It does. It's true. Issue of I've kind of struggled with that. I try not to use plastic bags. I have my little reusable bags and stuff, but putting out your recycling is a dilemma. So sometimes I snatch a few spare paper bags at the grocery store to put my recycling in. Because they told us we could put out disposable bins with the R, and they were just going to dump them. And then they took those and threw them in the garbage and went away with my little disposable bins. So I'm back to paper bags. But Mr. Chair, I think this is actually an excellent idea. I'm familiar with some of the anecdotes that the witness provided, driving by the landfills with the swirl of paper bag or plastic bags that kind of line the freeway. And I'm familiar with the Anacostia River in D.C. once in a while and the accumulation of plastic bags up and down the banks of those rivers is pretty remarkable. Plastic bags are kind of a curse.
Senator Dibble, what do you think about plastic water bottles?
They're a curse, too.
I think I have to dust off that revenue estimate I got from the department last year.
I've taken to, the mayor of Minneapolis is encouraging everyone to use those little, because the water in Minneapolis is so good, encouraging everyone to carry their little refillable bottles around. So I have one of those now that I carry around with me.
Senator Dibble, do you fill it at those new water fountains? What do those water fountains cost?
I think they actually end up building one or two of those. So.
How many did they build?
One or two, I think. Yeah.
Senator Limmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a couple questions. First, I wanted to ask Senator Senjem if he's seen these plastic bags hanging on every corn stalk around Rochester. I was wondering, he represents Rochester. I was just wondering if he's seen them all.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, not to that degree. And for those that know Rochester, actually, we use waste energy, so we don't haul these off to a landfill. So if they're out on the corn stalks or on the fence posts, I don't know quite how they get there because the incineration facility is actually pretty much in town.
Okay. The other question I wanted to ask, Mr. Chair, is there's rather some startling statistics about the use of bags. It's something that I really didn't know that much about. I'm glad I have this here, but if this is such a terrible problem, why don't we just ban these bags from being used and not tax anybody? Have you thought of that? Or is this more of a question of just raising money and not getting rid of this curse of plastic bags? What's it going to be? And I think we need to have that policy discussion.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Limmer, as I said when I started my presentation, this issue was brought to me by Mr. Johnson. I found it very interesting, and I thought it would be something that would be worthy of discussion in the legislature.
Well,
banning is another idea. It's not exactly the idea that was brought to me. I am here to help my constituent bring his idea to you.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Berglund, after looking at the statistics that's been presented today, I would think it would be in the stronger public interest to simply ban these bags and maybe take it in a stepped fashion and then try and figure out what to do with paper. The paper definitely is a cost, but it does decompose. The plastic is maybe cheaper to make, but according to this, it doesn't decompose for 1,000 years, but someone's figured out that when it does decompose, it'll decompose in tiny little pieces, and I'm not sure how they arrive at that conclusion, but nevertheless, I guess I would rather just see a ban on these things rather than, because of the, I'm afraid that for a few pennies a piece, people will still use them, and I'm not sure if we're really going to get rid of the environmental hazard that it creates. Has there been discussion about this?
Yes. In Washington, D.C., where they have imposed this tax, they've seen in just a few months, immediately after imposing it, bag usage dropped by 50%, and in this Atlantic article yesterday and over the last week, we've heard that it's actually dropped by 85% now. So I think while it is very ideal to think that we could just outright ban the plastic bags, at the same time there are going to be trade-offs with that. Businesses will have to incur more expenses because of paper. At the same time, so it's one of these issues where I think we could go to that extreme end, but when we have a huge deficit, we're facing budget issues in the state, and we have this potential to raise $20 million in the state. At the same time, we're able to reduce this consumption and really do something about the litter problem. I think it's just in everyone's interest.
Mr. Chair, in this proposal of the 5 cents per bag, there's a one penny that'll go back to the retailer. Do you have an estimate of how much retailers will make as a new windfall on this?
Yes, it's $9.7 million.
And that's over the entire industry?
Yes, the retail industry.
That's a lot of bags, $9 million to get a penny a piece out of. If it's nothing more than a few keystrokes on a cash register for the cost of the bags, Why are we giving the retailers a penny off each bag? Wouldn't it be okay if the state wanted to collect the 4 cents per bag, why don't we just leave it at that and not impose another, well, essentially a de facto tax, but it's not government collecting it, it's the retailers collecting it. And it's just an added cost to the consumer, and it's putting more money into a grocer that really doesn't have any added expense into it. So why are we imposing that onto the cost of food?
And Senator Berglund?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Limmer, actually, it was one of the few things that the retailers had to say that was good about the bill in the previous committee I had it in.
I'm sure they did.
They appreciate the fact that we recognized in the bill that they would have some costs for keeping track of these bags and collecting the revenue. And obviously, if the committee chose to take that out of the bill, they could. But I feel like it helps us to get them to promote the use of reusable bags, and I think that's...
Senator Berglund, I think allowing them to keep 20% of the revenue is pretty overly generous, I think. Senator Limmer?
Well, Mr. Chair, it's exactly right. And it's kind of interesting how you are trying to change public behavior. I understand that. I understand the cost factor involved. I understand the hazard of what these plastic bags do to the environment. But it's always amazing to me to see how ambivalent some corporations become when you offer them a $9 million windfall or industry-wide, when they really don't have to do a whole lot to change their system other than ring it up. I think any business, an industry statewide would be looking at a $9 million windfall for just adding a few keystrokes onto the cash register. I think that is rather excessive. And it is amazing how ambivalent they become once they realize that there's a added value to now becoming environmentally conscious.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if you can further break down that $9 million, but it strikes me that there's an awful lot of businesses that use where you get a bag with a purchase, and I can't imagine that it's that much of a windfall. I mean, for businesses all over the state.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Scheid, Senator Berglund said that that was the main reason why the businesses were now in favor of the bill. But before they were.
I didn't say they were in favor of the bill.
Well, they're not in favor of the bill.
I read the list of the people we have so far that are in favor of the bill, but there are retailers that have concerns about the bill also.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, nevertheless, I think calling it a windfall is kind of an exaggeration, a large exaggeration, you know, when you consider the number of businesses. I mean, if you go into the gas station and buy a couple candy bars, you get a plastic bag. You know, you don't have to take it. And, you know, I tend not to do that now since Senator Berglund introduced the bill. But,
Mr. Chairman, there also would be costs, at least initially, to changing their software. So,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Does this nickel a bag apply to every bag? Is it like Senator Scheid mentioned, you can get a little bag in a hardware store for a couple candy bars, but if you go to the Fleet Farm store and you get these big orange bags, and they're big plastic, and they're about 3 feet wide and about 5 feet tall, and you can stuff them full of everything. My kids actually use them at the Osseo Senior High because their colors are black and orange, and they turn them upside down, and they cut a hole in them, and they wear them. Some glee club thing, but at football games. But is it going to be a nickel for the little tiny bag and a nickel for the big Fleet Farm bag, or is there a cost that is proportionate to the scale of the size of the bag?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Limmer, on page 4, line 4.8, it talks about what is not considered a disposable bag. Bags that are used for nuts and vegetables, candies, prepared foods, bags used by pharmacists to contain prescription drugs, newspapers, laundry and dry cleaning. Some things are exempt.
Okay.
But, Mr. Chairman,
Senator
for
Berglund.
Purposes of simplicity, it's just easier to administer this if you just have a flat amount per bag that would be covered.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair. We don't tax groceries for a reason in the state of Minnesota. And this is just an end run around taxing groceries, it seems to me, because the grocery buyer will pay the tax. The retailers will have an initial cost the first year, but that windfall or the 1 cent, $9 million, will recur every single year. And the state will collect money every single year until we phase out
the plastic bags. But those that are less informed will be buying the plastic bags until they learn. I just wonder what we're doing. I agree with Senator Limmer that if we really believe that plastic bags are so terrible, we should just ban them, ban the use, and then not ask grocery buyers to pay taxes for buying groceries.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, first of all, you pay taxes on a lot of grocery non-food items.
Right.
But this is a choice. And you can take your disposable bags to the grocery store, and we do. And you can choose whether or not to pay the tax. And maybe if you pay the tax a couple times, you'll figure out not to use the grocery bags or to bring your own. So it's a matter of choice at that point. It really isn't imposing anything on grocery buyers.
I think, Senator Scheid, to your point, if you look at the revenue estimate, the amount retained by retailers goes from $9.7 million in 2011. In 2013, it's at $3.7 million. So, I mean, behavior must be changing because sure. There are less bags to collect the tax on in the out years. But Senator Berglund, have you given any consideration to a word other than tax? the guy, what did Senator Day used to say? The son of a truck driver in the corner office might object to the word. I'm wondering if there's another word we can use. Might not be quite so obvious. Senator Limmer, any thought?
I'm speechless, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bergen, have you thought about that?
No, I haven't, but I do agree with Senator Scheid. It is an incentive, so you know maybe we would call it something along those lines of a reusable bag incentive. And I do believe that it is voluntary also. I have grocery stores in my district that don't provide you a free bag.
Yeah.
Because it costs money, and they reduce the price of their groceries by not providing the bags, and people bring their own bags all the time to those stores. So the bags may not be charged at the register today when they give them to you, but they do have a cost, and that cost is built in.
I think, again, just to mention what Senator Berglund said and to address Senator Ortman, is that already consumers are paying for bags at retailers. So this is actually going to help by reducing consumption. It's going to lower the price of goods for consumers. So at this point, if Senator Scheid walks in and grabs a candy bar off the shelf and buys it, you know, she's paying for a bag whether she takes one or not. So in a way, she's being punished right now under our current economic system. And this voluntary tax, I also looked up last night, it's I guess called a Pigouvian tax, factoring for negative externalities, in this case being pollution. And so this is just correcting a current market imbalance.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Well, to your point then, the grocery buyer or the food buyer pays twice. Not only do they pay for the bag when the retailer buys the bag, that's worked into the price of the items, but then they pay a tax on top of that, is what you're saying. So those people that use the plastic bags, maybe because they're uninformed or don't get with the program right away, they pay twice for the bag. And I don't know how you could call that an incentive when it's clearly a tax. I don't think it's a double charge to anybody that happens to use a plastic bag.
Well, if the tax offsets the price in the initial expense, then that would be offset in the price of goods.
Well, Mr. Chair, is there something that says the retailers then will give a credit back on the bag buying program for all the $9 million that they collect in the tax?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Ortman, the bill does provide an incentive for retailers to give a credit to people that use reusable bags. So, you know, it is part of, there are some retailers now that do give you a credit if you bring a bag back and use it again. And those retailers would be rewarded in the bill the way it's drafted now.
When it would. Senator Berglund, thank you, and to your witnesses. Let's. Is there anybody else who wants to testify in support of the bill? I suspect there might be one or more people that want to testify in opposition. Nobody else in support of it? People who are opposed to the bill, how many would like to testify? Mr. Anderson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and thank you for your indulgence. My name is Buzz Anderson. I represent the Minnesota Retailers Association, and I'm also speaking on behalf of the Midwest Hardware Dealers Association, of which there are 200 members in Minnesota. I did commend Senator Berglund in the Commerce Committee for giving the 1 cent incentive to retailers, but I also said that I wish the state would seriously consider a vendor collection allowance for collecting sales tax, at large, because, in fact, there was a study done by NCSL, the National Association of Tax Commissioners, and the private sector, jointly funded, that said it costs retailers anywhere from 3.9% to 11+% administratively to handle the sales tax. So currently, we collect the sales tax free of charge. It costs us millions of dollars administratively to administer it and send it back to the state. So it was in that context that I commended Senator Berglund for putting the 1 penny in for retailers. It doesn't cover the cost, but having said that, I am here to speak in opposition to Senate File 2338. And I don't want my objection to be misinterpreted. On the contrary, many of our members have tried very successfully to voluntarily encourage people to not use paper and plastic. Further, many of our members voluntarily collect plastic bags at their locations, not just their bags, but everybody's bags, that bring them to the store location, and they recycle them successfully into reusable products, and they do that at no cost to the customers. So what are we doing as a retail community? You've probably noticed that in many more stores that you go into now, they ask you, do you want a bag? And just that act alone encourages people not to take a plastic bag for the candy bar or the fountain pen or the pack of cigarettes or whatever they're buying. And we've already seen a dramatic reduction in the number of paper and plastic bags that people use simply by asking that question, because we're trying to encourage them not to do this. Also, a very large number of our members sell reusable bags at cost or below cost to encourage people not to use paper and plastic. Some already offer a credit. You may have seen that. You go into a number of stores, if you bring in a reusable bag, they will credit you for that. And we think that's another way to try to encourage people not to use paper and plastic. Many, as I said, voluntarily collect plastic of all types and take it and recycle it into reusable products. So, I think the marketplace is working. We're sending the right signals. The public is responding. And I think that's a really positive for actions by retailers, consumers, and it's a positive thing for the environment. Now, let me say a couple of other things. My members strongly believe that it's good to reduce the use of paper and plastic. But there's still the point that retailers like to offer people that want a bag when they buy something, they want to offer them a bag as an option, as a courtesy to the customer. And what ends up happening under this bill is that we will end up having a disagreement with some customers asking whether or not they really have to pay the 5 cents. Will people object to this? Yes, they will. And they won't blame us, or they won't blame you. They'll blame us for that additional fee. It's only 5 cents, but they are going to object to it. In fact, the state, in the state of Washington, the city of Seattle, they imposed a bag tax. And through initiative and referendum, it was brought before the voters at the last election, and they voted overwhelmingly, 60-some percent, to eliminate the bag tax. People are very irritated by the very thought of this. And we don't want to argue with our customers. We want it to be a positive, good experience for them in the store. Also trying to assess from customers how many bags they're going to use when they're doing self-checkout, that becomes a bit of a nightmare in itself, and it's rather complicated. Creating another requirement to show a tax on a point-of-sale receipt. Senator Lember, it is more than just, you know, putting something in a cash register. Many people spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to change their point-of-sale systems to make this additional correction. And furthermore, creating the hassle of remitting another sales tax on the 20th of the month becomes more costly and more complicated for the retailer, not to mention the fact that the state is now considering moving the date for the remittance of the sales tax from the 20th to the 14th. That makes this even more complicated. The bill calls for the 20th. So do we pay all 90% of our current sales tax on the 14th with the remainder on the 20th along with this tax? Again, it gets very complicated and very costly and administratively difficult to do. And I'm just saying this adds to that complication. Sorting through the exemptions, although there are some good exemptions here, does become somewhat problematic. For example, if you go to the hardware store and you get some screws, nuts, and bolts, those are exempted. But if you throw in a hammer and screwdriver and a tape measure, that bag then has to be taxed. On the other hand, if you get a suit from a dry cleaner, it's exempted. But if I get a suit or a dress from a department store, it is not exempted. So again, you can see how this causes complications for trying to instruct employees what to do, trying to get people to understand when they do and do not owe the tax. So it's one more cost, it's one more step, it's one more potential hassle with customers. And as I said, we don't want to have hassles with customers. We want them to have a good shopping experience. We want the checkout to be hassle-free, and we don't want to incur a lot of administrative costs. With that, I will just ask you please not to vote to accept this as part of Minnesota tax policy, and I will stand for any questions.
Mr. Anderson, it seems like there's some general agreement that disposable plastic bags, that their use should be minimized. How about if we just, like somebody indicated on the committee, we just ban them? We put a date out like 6 months from now, a year from now, and we just ban disposable plastic bags. How would you feel about that?
Well, Mr. Chair, I wouldn't encourage anybody to ban a potential product that customers want to use. We're already trying as a retail industry to try to encourage people to use less paper and less plastic. You know, someone else might want to address that. But having said that, that is actually going to increase the number of paper bags that we use too. And I think Senator Bergen has already pointed out that it takes more energy to make the paper. It also takes more energy to transport the paper to the store. I mean, in some sense, plastic is more environmentally sound in some ways. So, you know, it needs to be a trade-off.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Anderson, you talked about how successful the voluntary programs that the retailers have undertaken are. And I've been to American Industries. I've seen where they bail up the plastic bags, and I've seen it's in the bag bins where you can come and bring your bags and dump them off at the grocery stores. So I know that there are efforts going on through the Chamber of Commerce, through WasteWise, and in the retail outlets. But how successful, when you talked about dramatic success, what kind of numbers? How many bags are being reclaimed, recycled, or refused? And how does that compare to some of the tax programs and schemes that other jurisdictions have undertaken?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, I can't give you a number. I can try to find some numbers, and I think I can probably be relatively successful at doing that. It's in the hundreds of thousands of pounds of plastic bags, and that's a lot of bags that are being recycled, you know, that we're talking about. And I will get you some more specifics because WasteWise and In the Bag program is tracking some of that. We also have members who are voluntarily, by the way, at their convenience stores putting up the containers to take back plastic water bottles and plastic pop bottles and stuff too. So again, they're doing that at their own expense to try to encourage people to be more environmentally conscious.
Senator Berglund, comment on that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it's less than 10% of the bags are being recycled, and that has been taken into account in the materials that we've handed out to you today. I also would just like to correct one other thing, or at least make it clearer as to what Mr. Anderson said. In Washington State, the bag tax was 20 to 25 cents. in D.C. the tax is 5%, is 5 cents. And in D.C., the polling that's been done shows that it has over 55% support of the people in that community. It's been very well accepted, and it's been very successful in its goals.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Schein.
Mr. Chairman, I mean, I'm sympathetic to what retailers have to put up with in the way of uncompensated costs, and so it figures into the price of our product. One of the issues that was brought to my attention earlier this year are the interchange fees. And I don't happen to use a credit card at the grocery store, but I pay cash or write a check. I'm paying something in the cost of my groceries for those fees that other people are, you know, they're paying them as well. But I guess I kind of resent that, and I think if more people knew about that, they'd be more angry than about the nickel a bag, which is their choice. I have no choice otherwise for some of the other kinds of costs that are built in. And that's not the only one, but that one really upsets me. And we can't do much about that because that's paid. That goes to the banks.
It's a congressional.
Who apparently need the money. So, you know.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scheid, I'd love to have a long conversation about that. That bill was actually introduced on a Thursday in the House, scheduled for a hearing on Tuesday in the House, and pulled from the committee because of its controversial nature. We as retailers have no say in what the interchange fee is going to be.
I know.
And in Minnesota, you cannot use a debit card. Well, that's not true. You can use a debit card, but the retailer gets charged the credit card swiping fee.
Right.
And you're right, that is built into the cost of products. It'd be nice if you could use the PIN pad in Minnesota. It would save consumers and retailers a lot of money.
And Senator Scheid, the interchange fees are how much? 2%, 3%?
I think they vary, Mr. Chairman, depending on the company and that also the arrangement or the contract they have with that individual company, I think.
Mr. Anderson, any idea kind of what they kind of arrange interchange fees run in as a percentage?
I would say Senator Scheid's probably correct. Maybe, and I can't say this authoritatively, only anecdotally, probably 1.5 to 2%. But if you if you're a retailer and you accept credit or debit cards, you can be charged 197 different ways on your monthly statement in terms of how the card is swiped or not swiped, in terms of how the card is qualified for the transaction. So it's very complicated and it's very costly to retailers.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm with what you said earlier about just banning them all together, not worrying about a tax, and educating people to use cloth bags.
Senator Limmer, what do you think about that?
Well, I hope I'm winning some people over, Mr. Chair. I think I might be, but we wouldn't have even had this discussion had not Senator Berglund's constituent brought it forward. Some of our best ideas for development come from constituents rather than bureaucrats. And so I'm glad we're having this discussion. Might need a little more polish, but I think we're kind of on a generally good track. But I don't think we've figured out all the details.
Mr. Chairman, I also just wanted to say that I don't have any preference as to what day of the week or month this fee would be collected. If it can be streamlined into the collection time of other taxes, that's fine with me. And, you know, maybe this bill won't happen this year, but I think it's a good discussion for us to have. And I believe, you know, we can also be discussing banning. I have a feeling you have a few more people at the table if you're going to ban them than you do today, but it would be an interesting discussion to have.
Senator Berglund, it'll probably be too late for them to come to the table if we make that decision.
Well, I think it would have to be in a different committee than this one.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. I think Senator Berglund just made one of the points I was going to make to Mr. Anderson's critique about some of the administrative issues. I think those are fairly easily resolved with some work on the bill. So, and I think Senator Berglund has been pretty responsive to some of the critiques of the business community, and it sounds like she's still in a posture. I hope we do move forward with this. You know, we didn't always have plastic bags here in this country. They started with them in other countries, and I used to live, my dad was in the Air Force, so I lived in other countries, and it was very, they were around when I was a little kid, and, you know, we talk about how progressive and advanced Europe is, but you can believe the litter problems they have in Europe or parts of Europe, and, you know, the roads are just lined with these plastic bags in some parts of Europe and have been for decades, and when they came to this country, I really was sorry to see them show up in our stores. I don't know how long it's been, 15, 20 years, but it hasn't been all that long that they've been as ubiquitous as they are. And sure enough, you know, they started showing up in our community as litter before too long. So I'd love to get a handle on these things. No
Senator
pun intended.
We're talking about a tax on disposable paper and plastic bags, and the committee seems to be leading towards an idea that maybe we should just have a ban on plastic disposable bags rather than put an additional tax on it. What do you think?
Not a good idea.
The tax or the ban?
Ban.
Why? I
think we could get the governor to sign the tax if we gave it a different name.
I don't want to think about this right now.
We had a head start on you.
Mr. Chair? I'd like to commend Senator Ress for her thoughts.
Anybody else?
Members?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Langstedt.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure how a plastic bag is defined, but when I know going to a grocery store, an awful lot of the product is in a plastic bag. Then you go to the counter, then you put it in another plastic bag. Do you pay for two plastic bags when that happened? Plastic bags for vegetables and so on are a preservative to a large extent, and they don't start spoiling until you open the bag. So I was just wondering if both of them would be taxed?
No, Mr. Chairman, there is a section in the bill that Senator Bach pointed out that exempts plastic bags that are used to contain a product at the retail level. We're only talking about the bags that things get put in to be taken home.
Okay.
That's interesting.
And I do agree that those bags are more voluntary. If you want one, you pay for the convenience of having it. Otherwise, you would be bringing your own bags to put things in to take them home, or you would be carrying something out without a bag at all.
So, Senator Berglund, in the exceptions, it seems like if I buy a pound of hamburger, we can still wrap it in a plastic bag before we put it in my reusable one. Is that
yes.
The intent?
Yes.
Any other thoughts, members?
Mr. Chair, and
Senator Sandra.
And to that point, then, would that first plastic bag be taxed a nickel?
No.
Okay.
Under the bill, it would be an exemption.
Would anybody else like to testify against the bill? Otherwise, I want to have the department come up. I've got a couple of questions for the department.
Mr. Chair, just maybe for Mr. Anderson. I don't think this is a severe problem, but will we have people standing at the counter, you know, telling the bag boy or girl, whatever the case might be, or person, you know, right now most people don't have any control over, you know, what goes into what bag, and they don't frankly care. To save a nickel, are we going to have people at the counter saying no? Put, you know, I don't know. Put the eggs in with the fruit, or I don't know what mixes and what doesn't. But people that do grocery shopping do. And are we going to have those kind of discussions at counters to further slow down the process?
Senator Sandrum, a guy your size doesn't shop for groceries?
No.
As I said earlier, there are stores today that don't give free bags.
Hey.
And, you know, they just put the groceries back in your grocery cart and you bag your groceries yourselves with bags you brought, or you take your cart out to your car and put your items in the car without a bag. So I really believe all of these little problems that people think might occur will be worked out fairly easily.
Senator Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Berglund, this is the second time I've heard the bill. And Since I've heard it the first time in Commerce, I've started to walk out of the store without a bag if it's one item.
I'm so glad to hear that.
And it's an education process, yeah. And I truly think we can get all the way to reusable cloth bags. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I hope so. I do see the fiscal notes showing, you know, the same trend that they saw in Washington, D.C. with a great reduction over time of the use of single-use bags.
I bet, Senator Berglund, if we did something with plastic water bottles, we'd see less of those, too.
I'm all for it, Mr. Chairman. I brought my own bottle.
I noticed that.
Yeah.
Unlike your constituent.
I didn't reuse it. I've been reusing it.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Can we have the department come up? Ms. Cadoon, when a grocery store or a retailer purchases, I suppose they buy them by the pallet, of plastic bags or paper bags, do they currently pay sales tax on that purchase?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe they do.
So is that figured into the revenue estimate that as they purchase less, the state will forego that sales tax? I didn't see it in the summary.
Mr. Chair, members, I'll have to double-check on that. When I read the revenue estimate, it does not seem evident that that was included. So I'll follow up on that and get back to you.
Any questions of the department members? Ms. Cadoon?
Mr. Chair, I did just want to mention that there would be a fiscal note. There would be additional administrative costs to the department if we did a tax like this. I also want to mention some of the things that was mentioned by the Retail Association as well, is that there's would be some administrative issues with this. And I think if it would be to move forward, there'd really be some needed work on the bill. For example, right now you have them remitting monthly, whereas for sales tax, for example, we have annual filers, quarterly and monthly, depending on their activity. So I would think you'd want to pattern it something more similar to that. You have them doing a separate tax ID number just if they're selling bags. I would think you'd want to do maybe see if they could piggyback on their sales ID number. Another issue is, for example, just on the definition of consumers, you're defining consumer, and then you're excluding purchasers by nonprofit organizations, government units. And if you're going into a store trying to discourage paper or plastic use, I don't know why I necessarily want to define consumer in that way. So there'd be, I think, if this would be to move forward, a lot of some administrative changes, as Senator Dibble pointed, probably aren't it certainly could be worked out, but there's definitely some work that's needed.
Thank you, Ms. Cadoon. Any questions, members? Thank you, Ms. Cadoon.
Sure. Thank you very much,
Senator
Mr.
Berglund,
Chairman.
Thank you. Chair lays over Senate File 2338 for possible inclusion. Senator Rest.
Chairman, could I do Senate File 3053 first?
That's 3053?
That's correct, and I have a delete everything amendment.
There's a delete everything amendment to Senate File 3053. Senator Rest moves the delete all amendment, the A1. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
After no, motion prevails. Senator Rest, to the bill as amended.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 3053 requires the Department of Revenue to conduct a study of the fiscal disparities program. and then report back to the two tax committees by, I think it is 2011. The report is due February 1st of 2012. When we first introduced the bill, it was far more ambitious, but in meeting with the Department of Revenue, which has been extremely helpful in pointing out those areas of a study that would be feasible, that would be practical, and that would actually give members of the legislature and the governor, for that matter, some really good information about what is happening in the fiscal disparities program, and then also not to ask the department to make recommendations to the legislature, but to pose questions to us about what policy issues we should be considering with that program. And so the study now, as opposed to looking at or stating some goals and asking the department to determine how well those goals have been met, that instead of that, that the study will analyze such things as the, if you look at the Delete Everything Amendment, the extent to which the benefits of economic growth of the region are shared throughout the region, especially for growth that results from state or regional decisions, which we can track, to look at some statistical data with regard to the variability of tax rates across jurisdictions of the region, and looking to see whether they within that both, you know, toggle on, toggle off with regard to fiscal disparities. To look at what we usually don't do, but is part of feasibility, to look at the impact on the distribution of homestead property tax burdens, again, across the jurisdictions and the regions, and to, in number four, to look at something else we don't do very often, and that is the impacts of the program and the overburden on jurisdiction that contain properties that provide regional benefits, specifically costs those types of properties imposed on their host jurisdictions in excess of their tax payments. A big mall, churches don't pay, but nevertheless, you know, what kind of burden particular properties bring to bear on the local jurisdictions that go beyond their tax payments. And the one of the things that I'm also interested in, it's not a number, but are lines 19 and 20, is to ask the department to really provide a detailed description of all the other property tax aid and local development programs that interact with the fiscal disparities program. I was telling a gentleman from the department that I had once written a paper for a public finance course on the cross purposes of tax increment financing and the fiscal disparities program in the metropolitan area here. And it would be that kind of thing that I would be really, really interested in, where the but-for test comes up, that if you don't do it, or if you don't do it, it will the redevelopment. If you don't allow the TIF, the redevelopment won't get done. But then, on the other hand, looking at the way in which you spread across the region the economic wealth of the jurisdiction that made that but-for decision, and to provide us with some questions going forward on the fiscal disparities program, which really hasn't been studied or analyzed in this instance for a number of years, and certainly very few changes have been brought about in it. The funding, obviously, is always an issue for any proposal that comes before the committee, and we think that using the fiscal disparities, $100,000 of the fiscal disparities levy to conduct this study is a very worthwhile use of the revenues in the fiscal disparities program. And I do have some testifiers, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. If I could ask a question at this point, Senator Rest. And Ms. Zoff can help me out a little bit here. This is a question I brought up to her towards the beginning of session, and it was an issue that was brought up to me by a constituent. And that is in those instances when jurisdiction has experienced some appeals of property taxes, particularly by large commercial interests who feel like their value is less than, so they've gone and they appealed and they've received a reduction in their property taxes. I don't think there's ever any adjustment, to their relationship to their fiscal disparities pool that results from those decisions, either prospectively or retroactively. I think it's still kind of counted in the original value of their commercial industrial tax base is counted in the mix, and there's no recognition of that lowering value. Is it possible to? I read the language of the study. I don't think we would necessarily need to add any language. I just wanted to kind of mark that as an issue and maybe highlight that as something that should be examined. Just to examine, consideration of what a jurisdiction's contribution is or benefit is from the fiscal disparities pool when they're experiencing some fluctuations that result from these. What is that process called when they appeal their tax value and get a reduction?
Abatement.
Abatement, yeah. When they receive an abatement as a result of an appeal of their assessed value.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's a very good point.
Thank you.
I don't know, and I don't know that it needs to be added as an
item. I don't think it does. I think it can be construed within the language of your
commercial
study.
Property valuation, I think, could be very helpful. And again, it also is different across the region. I mean, there are some areas where home values, for example, are at least on the tax rolls, are holding very steady. And there are others in communities where, I think in a lot of New Hope, where I live, the value in the last 2 years has dropped 30%. I think that's an interesting question.
Mr. Chair, for the record, the constituent who brought this up to me actually works for a suburban jurisdiction, so this isn't actually a Minneapolis question, just for the record. Although we do experience significant abatements when the market is down from our downtown CI tax base. We've seen dramatic fluctuations.
Senator Pogemiller.
Senator Ress, isn't there an annual report? Isn't there an annual report on the distribution of this? Somebody prepares that or gives that to us?
Mr. Chairman, there is an administrative auditor that prepares that has traditionally been the Anoka County auditor. That not only has a distribution report, but that does the calculations for how much is being brought in and then how it's being redistributed based on, redistributed based on population and collected based on wealth. A couple of years ago, I think, brought into play getting rid of the lag year that we had previously had because they weren't able to get the information together, but I think that's now been resolved.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogemiller.
Is the language you're looking for a programmatic audit here? You basically want to figure out if the benefits of the redistribution are what people hope they would be.
That's what you're trying to do.
I would, Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogomile, that would certainly be the overall goal. But we wanted the study language to be couched so that it actually could be, there could be some practical ways of going about doing the study rather than asking for the Department of Revenue to come back with judgments. Instead of that, coming back with analyses that will allow the legislature to make some judgments. And they, I think the department is also, in terms of their policy analysis, looking for projects like this that could be helpful to the legislature, and I think this might serve as a model.
Senator Pogomile.
Chairman, Senator Russ, I was actually wondering if the Commissioner of Revenue is the right one to do the study. I'm not convinced that that's the case. And I support where you're headed and what you're trying to do here, but I'm not sure that's the right.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if we could have the department come forward, and this would be actually, Mr. Chairman and Senator Pogomiller, almost the first of its kind of asking the department to engage in this kind of analysis for us. It's different from the program evaluation that would be asked, and we talked about this, of the Legislative Auditor's Office, because we would not be asking the department to necessarily give us recommendations for how we ought to change the law. They don't see that as and he can speak for himself, but they didn't see that as their role in this. Very, very different than the requirement that the legislative auditor, when his office does a program evaluation, they're looking for ways, you know, in the statute it says, look for ways to save money, look for ways to give better service, and make legislative recommendations. And I think this is a different kind of base of information that we're looking for. But it's certainly, thank you for noticing, it's something very different that we have not, in my opinion at least, we have not asked the department to do before. But
Mr. Willett, do you need to do this study in consultation with somebody else, or do you feel qualified?
Mr. Chair and Senator Pogomiller, the way I would envision tackling this report, there is the appropriation for $100,000 that we would intend to use most, if not all of that, for contracting with an academic who specializes in public finance or something like that to guide the study. I would point out that the delete everything amendment, and I do appreciate Senator Ress's willingness to meet with us and talk about it, takes what I think was a lot of those more subjective questions out of the bill compared to the original language. What we tried to get to was questions that where we can do statistical analysis, we can bring back results of those analyses and pose questions, that we see in the analysis, and it would be the judgment of the legislature of what to make of those and whether changes should be made to the program or not.
And that might include also looking at the VOS database, too.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that is one thing that we would have the ability to do now is if we look at a scenario of how would taxes be spread differently without this program, not only can we look at would tax rates be more or less variable, but would homestead tax burdens be more or less variable? And I think that would be an interesting piece.
And Mr. Willett, is $100,000 the right number?
Mr. Chair, I have no idea. we conduct studies, but we don't contract a lot, at least in my experience at the department. I think it would at least it seems like it should be adequate to hire someone who has a lot more practical public finance expertise than we have at the department. Whether we'd be able to deliver on everything we would want to do under this with that amount, I don't know. But it is. It seems like it should be a decent amount of money to try and tackle this.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. To Senator Rest, I kind of like some of the qualitative questions you had in the kind of the original design. Is it your intention to come back with the data that the department is able to generate and do some of that qualitative policy analysis, and how do you envision we do that? Because I'm really interested in the answers to those questions.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, yes, but it would be the legislature doing that based on what we would hope would be very good statistical analysis, et cetera.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
By the legislature, do you mean, are we going to ask for
help?
I mean, I don't feel brilliant enough as a legislator to answer these questions. Are we going to ask for help from other people to get to drill down to some of these qualitative answers to some of these qualitative questions? Our professional staff or external experts? Or
well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, I think that you know, that is that will be a matter of discussion by people who are really interested in the fiscal disparities program and using our getting the information back and then having discussions about with our own staff, with the House, with Senate counsel, with experts in the community that don't yet have this information presented in this way
mayor.
At this point. And the mayor, who
he's
I
brilliant.
Will get a chance to speak here in a second.
He's brilliant enough to help us, Mr. Chair.
Senator Orpin, then we'll hear from the mayor.
Mr. Chair, I'm concerned that what we're really doing is adopting these goals for the program, and I'm not sure that they're broad enough. I don't think it does a harm to do a study like this, but I think we should also have quantitative analysis. And I would hope that you would include something, Senator Rest. Oh, there's an A1. I'm sorry. I'll look at that while the mayor comments because I didn't realize we had an A1.
Mayor McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. Thank you for having me here. I'm Mayor Mike McGuire, City of Eagan. I'm also the board chair of the Municipal Legislative Commission. And I'm representing the MLC in support of and appreciation for Senator Rest's leadership on Senate File 3053. I'm also the incoming president of the Metropolitan Municipalities as well, and they're in support of the bill and the study. MLC communities are both contributors and recipients from the fiscal disparities pool, as are Metro Cities members as well. We're supportive of the study. We have no agenda for changes in the fiscal disparities program, but do believe that after 40 years, a lot has changed in the context of fiscal disparities. And at a time when we're looking at things like the relationship between the state and local governments to one another, it makes sense to also look at fiscal disparities as part of that mix. Since 1971, we've seen significant changes in how the state funds and works with local jurisdictions on school funding, on state aids and credits, on rates and compression rates for both CI and residential properties, and a state CI levy. And all of these things have, I think, changed the landscape that fiscal disparities operates within, while in the course of that 40 years, fiscal disparities has not been looked at, evaluated, and asked the questions about how it still fits into that context of things. So on behalf of the Municipal Legislative Commission and myself in the City of Eagan, we believe it's a good time for the study. We believe that the Department of Revenue is a good neutral researcher on this, and we support drawing on the pool. It's a fairly minimal draw. And it's not unprecedented. The draw from the fiscal disparities pool is 0.03% of the fiscal disparities pool, and it's again not an unprecedented draw. And just as an added bonus, the Department of Revenue has assured me that when they do deliver the study, they will not deliver it in paper bags, in plastic bags. Yeah. So that has I know it. Yes. It was a good one too. Thank you very much for having me.
Mr. Mayor, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
That's what happens when witnesses sit through other testimony.
Indeed.
Senator Orman.
Mr. Chair. Senator Rest or mm-hmm. Mayor or maybe the Department of Revenue, do you think that the way that the bill is currently drafted in the A1 amendment, that it is broad enough to include a study of the geographic contribution and benefit analysis? So you would say, New Germany contributes X, mm-hmm. but they are users. They are users of the fiscal disparities benefits, or they are not users of the fiscal disparity benefits. Do you think it's broad enough to include that study, that analysis?
Senator Rest, do we already have that information annually?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Ortman, I think that information is available. I think just a lot of us don't take it off the shelf and look at it. But, you know, Mr. Chairman, at some point it might be just interesting to, or at least to some of us, to have just a really wide-ranging discussion, policy discussion of and the history of the fiscal disparities program and what it's meant to the metropolitan area and, quite frankly, what it's meant to the range. We don't often talk about the Range Fiscal Disparities Act, but Senator Johnson certainly insisted upon having that at one point, and legislature accommodated that policy change, too. I don't know. We don't hear very much at all about that, but maybe it doesn't work in the same way that it works down here, but I think that'd be a good thing to do.
Well, Senator Rest, I think part of the reason you don't hear a lot is the property that's captured under it. We didn't go back nowhere near as far and pick up as much property. It was only from the date it was passed, I think like 96 or 97, new commercial property going forward from there. So There's not a lot of property being captured under it and redistributed in the range program, but someday there may be.
Someday it may be.
Right. Any other questions, members? Senator Rest, I think the House brought a fiscal disparities study to the conference committee a year or two ago, and I don't believe the department. Did we end up adopting that and do any work on that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Eric Ouellette from the department. I believe it was dropped. There were a number of other studies that the conference committee decided to have us do, and I think it was the judgment of the committee that this additional one might be a little bit too much. And we also did raise concerns last year with the language, which was more similar to what this bill started out as. We're more comfortable, I think, with the A1 amendment and being able to deliver on that, because there's less, we think, less subjective questions in the current language. So we're more comfortable with this than what was in the conference committee discussions last year.
Other questions, members? Mr. Willett, thank you. Mr. McGuire, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair leaves over Senate File 3053 as amended. Senator Rest, you have one more. Senate File 3289.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 3289. When we were putting into play as a tool for cities and their economic development activity, establishing economic development authorities, we permitted economic development authorities to set up something that was called an economic development district, not to be confused with the rules that govern economic development districts under the tax increment financing statute. However, the economic development districts that were established by the EDAs at that time in 1986 needed to abide by the rules in establishing them that were set in place for actually TIF redevelopment districts. And what this proposal does is to remove that language and that reference to the redevelopment districts, redevelopment TIF districts, which is at this point out of date with regard, after some 25 years, with regard to the changes that have been made in the redevelopment districts criteria in the tax increment financing statutes. So I hope that economic development districts language is not confusing, but that's what I understand that we would be doing 469-174 is the TIF redevelopment district criteria statute. And I have a couple of people here who can talk about why it would be helpful in the toolbox to get rid of what is really some obsolete language that has an effect on EDAs being able to do their work in the 21st century. So may I present my witnesses?
Let's hear from your witnesses. Great. Senator Ratz.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, committee members, Steve Buble, Kennedy and Graven Law Firm, on behalf of the Economic Development Association of Minnesota. I practice in this area for many, many years, and try to briefly explain what this is about. When EDAs create these so-called economic development districts, they're creating what's in the development world is referred to as a project or a project area. HRAs do the same thing. They create redevelopment projects. Cities create development districts, which are these are kind of broad planning areas within which they undertake their other activities. And when the EDA Act was created, EDAs were given this economic development district, which confusingly has the same name as another specific tax increment district. But this is the big, broad planning area. The requirement that to create this broad planning area, you have to meet the redevelopment TIF requirements, which requires more than 50% of the buildings are substandard, means that as a practical matter, you're not going to make those kind of findings for your big planning area. That's a more targeted idea for redevelopment TIF. So as a result, in the last 20-some years, EDAs have not created these large economic development districts, and whole pages of the statute are essentially not really available because you can't create these districts. Instead, though, EDAs were also given all the powers of an HRA and all the powers of a city under your development district statutes. So most EDAs still accomplish many of their activities, but by using one of these cross-reference powers. And what that has done is just created a great deal of confusion. It makes it an extra layer of activity and cost, really, by going through one of these other sets of powers. We think that probably that might have made some sense back in 1986 because, for one thing, you know, the EDA statute was brand new then. It wasn't sure how broad this was going to be. And also the cross-reference test to redevelopment districts was much, much broader in 1986. Since then, the requirements for those districts have become much, much tighter. So now there's a major disconnect in creating these big planning areas for economic development, but having to meet these very strict redevelopment tests. The other point I wanted to make is that this does not dramatically expand the powers of EDAs. All the things that they do in these project areas are still governed by statute, particularly tax increment. Tax increment is still, frankly, the most usable tool for EDAs. They will still have to meet, if they're creating a redevelopment district, they'll still have to meet those strict tests. If they're doing economic development, TIF, they'll have to meet those tests, manufacturing, warehouse, those kinds of things. So this is really a way of bringing the statute more into line with how it really works in the real world and making it cheaper and more understandable. I think that's a major difficulty right now. In fact, we even have a Court of Appeals decision from the year 2000 that dealt with an EDA that was acquiring property, and the court in a footnote indicated that this cross-reference to redevelopment TIF districts appears to be an error because they said, well, this doesn't really make any sense. So we have a court case almost saying this might be a typo, and that's you know, one of the reasons that we're here is to try to just simply make it easier for them to operate in these broad areas without really expanding their, you know, their fundamental powers.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pogomar.
So what criteria would an economic development district have to meet?
Well,
it doesn't have to meet the substandard one.
The proposal is that's simply a matter, because this is really more of it's a matter of disclosure. You have a public hearing. You say these are the areas within which we're going to do economic development activity. There aren't specific criteria, just as there aren't in some of our other statutes, for example, for municipal development districts. There really aren't a lot of findings that you have to meet there. The controls on this are all in your underlying powers. If you're going to do another kind of a TIF district, or if you're going to have to do any kind of another subsidy, we have a business subsidy statute that requires all those kind of findings. So we have so many other controls now that there isn't there isn't anything in particular to be gained by requiring a new set of findings just for that, for the economic development district itself, which again is kind of more of a planning concept.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Buble maybe could describe for us, you're looking it up yourself, maybe you can describe for us, what are the powers granted to EDAs in 469.090 to 469.108? What kind of activities typically occur or would occur in these economic development districts that get established?
Sure, Senator Dibble. The single most common one is buying and selling land, where you're helping assemble parcels, sell them off for redevelopment, in some cases making loans, certainly using tax increment. That's again, even EDAs, that's probably their most common tool, in which case when we're using tax increment, we have another layer of regulation that we may be doing. Besides the land acquisition, you may be helping doing public utilities, demolition, those kinds of things.
Can I ask a question on that point? The tax increment district in this case, the redevelopment district, typically would be a subset of the larger economic development district that you've established.
Exactly.
Senator Ortman.
Chair, mean that there are no limits to where the economic development powers may be used by an economic development authority in a city?
Just within the city boundaries. No, that's correct. It's essentially where the city council or the EDA board determines that economic development assistance would be beneficial.
Proper. So it could be in a neighborhood.
It could be. That's right. But most likely you aren't going to be doing economic development activity in a residential neighborhood, and in fact, that's not, you know, with most of your powers doing economic development are to do things that are, you know, creating tax base, creating jobs, those kinds of things.
If we adopted this, there would be no limitation to that. It could be done. We would be authorizing that.
It would be authorizing the EDA to decide the boundaries of this district, and it might include a residential neighborhood, but that's not going to give you additional powers to do something in that residential neighborhood if you didn't already have those powers. And I don't know what kind of powers you might have to do those kind of things. Keep in mind that you still have the EDA also has the HRA powers, so they can put on their HRA hat, housing and redevelopment, and if they're dealing with affordable housing, for example, that may be something that they would do, and that's something they could do today.
Without this change.
Even without this change, that's right. Yeah. I think the basic message, this doesn't really fundamentally change their powers. It makes it easier for them to exercise the powers that they already have without going through some extra, somewhat confusing hoops that you have to sort of explain to your citizens and staff and even many economic development professionals which just don't understand this whole setup.
We're doing is taking away any ambiguity in the question. The EDA wearing its HRA hat or its EDA hat can do anything within the city limits to promote economic development or housing redevelopment in any location.
I think that's basically correct, yes.
Why have a city council?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pogman.
Is there some struggle between an EDA and a city here going on? Is there something here that's not obvious going on?
I don't believe so. I mean, this is coming from the economic development professionals and from the lawyers, I would say, because this is so confusing. It's such a confusing area of law. This is not a question of a dispute
no
between cities and
on.
No fight going on whatsoever. No.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, maybe you could talk a little bit about the relationship between these economic development authorities and their powers and the city council. Is there any point at which the Economic Development Authority must go back to the City Council for approval, or are they working completely independently from the elected body?
Mr. Chair, Senator, EDAs are both created by the City Council, but through an enabling resolution that is almost like a charter, and in that resolution, they can put whatever limits they prefer, including a requirement that almost anything they do has to come back for council approval. Many of the things, even if you don't have that, many of the activities, particularly, again, tax increment, always require city council approval and city council hearings.
Well, Mr. Chair, then if we take away that tax increment requirement, then that would be eliminated, and that would give them more freedom, more opportunity not to be required to go back to the city council. Is that right?
Well, I think not in this case, because we're not changing any of the rules on tax increment. Again, all we're doing is giving them a little bit broader authority to define, as a matter of sort of public disclosure, this is the area within which we're going to designate this district. But then when you come back and you do a TIF district within that broader area as a subset, you're going to go back to the city council and have city council approval on you know, any. In most EDAs, the city council's approved most significant activity. And they have to by law in most cases.
Right, Mr. Chair, but they have to approve the tax increment financing district.
Correct.
And so if their charter said you can only do this where there's a tax increment financing, now you're outside the scope of their charter authorization, and they can do anything they want regardless of whether the city council has imposed a tax increment financing district.
There's nothing in this bill that would change the requirement, an EDA's authority to do tax increment. That's still going to follow all the laws, including city council approval. No EDA can create a TIF district anywhere without city council approval.
If they weren't using TIF.
Third double.
Thanks. Yeah, I think that's an important point to emphasize, that it's just the criteria of a TIF that they're required to look at. I'm curious, though. I have a question. In the case of Minneapolis, I know that their Economic Development Authority membership is the same as the city council. They just put on their...
It's very common.
MCDA hat. I'm wondering how common that if there's cross-representation or a contiguous representation of the electeds on the EDA body.
Mr. Chairman, often cities will convene, have a hearing as an EDA and convene that hearing, have that hearing, and then adjourn the hearing and reconvene as the city council. That is extremely common.
Great,
not just Minneapolis, but most suburbs that I'm aware of that have EDAs, the membership of the EDA is the same as the membership of the city council.
Other questions, members?
I have one more.
Senator Rest? Okay, one more
short witness.
Witness
here.
Yeah. I can be brief.
Not a short witness.
Yeah.
The witness is going to be brief.
My name is Jason Arzold. I'm the Economic Development Director for the City of Brooklyn Park. Also a representative of the Economic Development Association of Minnesota, who really brought this forward. And it is about just sort of making the practice of economic development easier within our communities. I think we support this for some of the same reasons that Mr. Buble outlined. We run into these same problems from time to time. Our EDA is made up of the same group of people that our city council is made up of for some of those reasons. Specifically, we became even more interested in this. We were able to, undertake most of our activities through some of those cross-reference powers that Mr. Buble outlined. But specifically, we were looking at, in light of sort of the economic circumstances, ways to provide capital to start up businesses and new businesses and things of that nature. And we began to explore options for that. And the EDA statute does provide for the authority to give or help with small business capital. That's written in the statute. However, if you do that, a business has to be located within one of these economic development districts, these broader planning areas that Mr. Buell talked about. And for the kinds of businesses that would benefit from this, they would not always necessarily be in a redevelopment area with on a piece of property with 70% of the buildings being substandard. And therefore, that took sort of this tool away from us for that reason. So it's in there as far as what's permitted, but we weren't able to access it because of these restrictions. And so that's another reason or a specific example why the City of Brooklyn Park is interested in a change to it.
Anything else, members? Senator Double.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just responding a little bit more to Senator Ortman, because I think she raises a significant and important question, and that's the accountability to the elected authority. There is a fairly significant section that describes the limit of powers of an EDA subject to the city. That's the sale of all bonds, any official actions that it would influence another jurisdiction, following the budget process of the city, any other limitation that the city establishes, plus the city, if it's not the city council members themselves, they do all of the appointments. So it seems that there are fairly strong and significant measures of accountability and authority that trace straight back to the city council. There may be more that we need to look at, but it seems like a very, very strong accountable relationship that EDAs have with their municipalities that authorize them.
Senator Rest, anything further? Charlie's over Senate File 3289 for possible inclusion.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Scheid.
Yes.
Senator Scheid, Senate File 2565.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Skoy just informed me we probably should have done this sooner. It's very straightforward. It increases the membership of the LGA study group from it would take it actually to 12 from 12 to 14. Right now, 5 members are appointed by the tax chair of both bodies, and then the chairs of those divisions that have jurisdiction over the over property taxes are also part of it. So I think it's correct that the membership is currently 12. This would take it to 14. It would add, actually what it ends up doing, the effect is it adds a couple of suburban members. And that is because there are some folks, particularly in the northern suburbs, who feel that since the suburbs make up about a third of the population, we should probably make up, and it would actually be, I think, a little over 28% of the membership of the LGA study group. So it would make it proportionate to their representation. I don't think it's terribly controversial. And
Senator Scheid, the Senate, I think, did their job putting people from the suburbs on.
Well, Mr. Chairman, yes, I am one. Yes, I think I need help.
Did the House not do as well?
There are other worthy suburban legislators here.
Name one.
Senator Limmer.
Senator Skoy, is this a good idea?
Well, I think this takes it from 10 to 12, and I don't think it's going to be a huge impact one way or the other, because as you said, the Senate did a pretty good job of appointing suburban members. I don't think it hurts anything.
Mr.
Senator Scheid, what's the number? Is there
10
on it or 12 currently?
Mr. Chairman, right now the tax chairs appoint 5 members, but the division chairs are also additional members of. So if you get down to line 119, it says the chairs of the divisions of the tax committees shall also be members and serve as co-chairs. So I think it's taking it from 12 to 14.
Senator Skoy, agree?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Pogemiller.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to put too fine a point out of this, but this may be the only thing that's created without the Committee on Committees of the Senate making the appointments. And I know this was done at the Tax Conference Committee, and I just wanted you all to notice that I noticed.
Senator Pogemiller, how do you feel about us adding 2 more people?
I think this should have gone to the Committee on Committees.
I think it should have gone to state and local.
Senator Skoy.
Oh, Mr. Chair, the only concern that I have is we start to designate who the committee members are, then the next group's going to come along and want their groups designated, and you know, then the Committee on Committees can designate the whole group, study group, to make. But I just don't know if we want to go down the road of telling the chairs who to appoint or not.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's good to have something in stone that, if you will, that says you have to have representative study group. And I think we've tried to do that. Right now, there are 7 members from Greater on the committee. There are 7 members from Greater Minnesota, 2 from Minneapolis, a staff member from the League of Minnesota Cities, and 2 representatives from the metro suburbs. That's
right.
Who's on the
Senator
committee.
Pogemiller.
7 from Greater
Senator Scheid, I have no trouble with your bill.
Right. Mr. Chairman.
I'm concerned about
the appointing authority.
The appointing authority. Because you do, again, I'm not making, I don't want to make too hard a point of this right now, but if every conference committee created these groups,
well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Mr. Chairman,
I assume I'm in the middle of some other kind of discussion here. I mean, that's so. I just would like you to consider this going forward, Senator, since you've already established the working group.
Senator Scheid, Senator Pogemiller, I'd have to go back and look, but I think the LGA study group was carried in the House bill, and the Senate, I believe, took it in conference, is the way I remember it. Is that, Council, is that right?
So
it's not as though the Senate went forward and sent a tax bill to conference and didn't go through the proper channels.
So, Mr. Chairman, so perhaps the Senate Tax Committee would mind fixing that right now? Or would that make it impossible to get Senator Scheid's bill passed?
I think so.
Not here, but with the House is what I'm
asking. Mr. Chairman, I have a question.
Senator Rest.
How many members of the committee, or the working group, or whatever it's called, are members of the minority party? Or Republicans?
Senator Scoy?
Currently.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, I think there's one majority party member.
No, the total group.
Well,
currently of the current membership, which as a practical matter is 12, how many are Republicans and how many are Democrats?
Mr. Chairman.
Well,
Mr. Chairman, these are nonpartisan kinds of, I mean, I think most people, I don't think we had to name our party.
I mean the legislators, Senator Scheid.
Senator Scoy is there. I'm there.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, the way
curious.
I read this language is there's two members.
The current membership is what I'm asking.
Yes. Yeah. There's two members of the Tax Committee, one of which is majority and one of which is minority, plus the Property Tax Division Chair. So there would be one minority member of the three legislators in each body.
It's 4-2. I'm just
4-2.
Getting some information.
Yeah,
it's just
4-2.
It's 4-2. Okay. And then the others that are from representatives from organizations, their political affiliation is incidental.
And Mr. Chair.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But Senator Scheid, I know you read off the members and who they are, but we don't specify that there are any rural members or any group came up, and now if we add this language and specify that two of the members must represent these groups of cities, will the other organizations, rural cities or coalition of greater rural cities, come and want to have membership specified?
Well, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I don't know how much this will change. I know you shared with me we've changed the report date to 2012 from 2010, so it's going to last another 2.5 years, and I don't know that it would be extended after that. I'm hoping, that it wouldn't have to be since it's a study committee. I don't know that a group that has 7 members on the from Greater Minnesota has 7 members on it, they're going to want to change that. I'm not wanting to change that, just wanting to make sure that there's more suburban representation. And actually, the idea came from city manager in one of the northern suburbs to Senator Betzold, and he asked me to carry the bill. But I don't disagree with it. I just wasn't trying to make any great political statement here about the poor suburbs or anything like that, but I think that the suburbs do see some disparities in how they're deemed and how they're treated, and that it would be important to have that perspective perhaps beefed up.
Senator Schott, I think the makeup of the appointed members is actually 5 metro and 5 rural, and it just so happens that the 2 division chairs happen to both be rural. I think that's all the, just by position.
No. So, no, Mr. Chairman, I don't think there was any plot. I just think that we should, you know.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Skoy.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, the other thing I would guess that when this study group reconvenes after this November election, it will be different. Mm-hmm. Because many people are elected members, and they won't be there, they won't be in that position. So I would expect that a lot of the members will be different.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
Senator Scheid, did you amend the report date? So it is going to be December 15th of this year?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest, that was in the supplemental budget reduction bill. That's already passed into law and signed by the governor.
Yeah. Okay, so what?
This would have to be changed then, I guess.
2010, if we were going to put this in the bill, would need to be 2012.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, maybe you should just move that to do that. And
well,
then
I also would move that we use the standard language for reporting to the legislature, which is to report specific recommendation to the chairs and ranking minority members of the committees with jurisdiction over tax policy by December 15th. 2012. Mr. Chairman, I would move that as an amendment.
Counsel, you have the language.
Yes. And the reason why you don't report to the legislature is because the legislature is not a person. You want your report to go to people.
And that's, Senator Rest, that's kind of boilerplate language, right?
Yes, it is.
So the report
mm-hmm.
would be back to the committee chairs and ranking and minority members of the
right.
committee with jurisdiction over tax policy?
That's correct.
And the date, moving the date from 2010 to 2012?
That's correct.
On the rest, oral amendment. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails.
And then, Mr. Chairman, just a general comment, and not about this, but piggybacking on what Senator Pogemiller said, there's absolutely no reason that this needs to be in law. The tax chair could have simply asked outside of any piece of legislation the property tax division chairs to meet with a group of people and talk about the local government aid study. And I think that you know, in the future we ought to be maybe a little bit more cautious. And I think that's what Senator Pogemiller is getting at, too. If you don't have to have statutory authority, whether it's law, session laws or in the statutes, to get a group together to talk about a policy decision, that's the chair's authority to go ahead and do that, and I rather than telling the chair to do it. And it's certainly the way in which I'm going to be proceeding with regard to looking at the TIF statutes. It's going to be anybody who wants to come and talk about it, and I've been getting really, really good information from Joanne from the state auditor's office, and I don't need a law to tell me that that's an interesting study to some of us.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, and I don't disagree with Senator Rest. Just, I'm actually going to be working on something like that myself concerning criminal sexual conduct, sentencing, and the policies that go around that, because we had some legislation and we realize it's a much, you know, more difficult subject than. But I will say this, that it's, as I'm thinking about going forward with that, it would be useful to have some kind of structure to know how to do that so that you have public meetings, that you have the appropriate people, you know, notified. And so I'm just telling you that that's something you know, that does go along with that. So there's some comfort in statutory direction, but I don't disagree with you at all.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
I agree with Senator Scheid. It creates more transparency. It creates more opportunity to participate. If it's in law and people can find what's happening, and that structure is really important, I think. And making sure that there's proper representation to meet all the interests and to reach out to all the interests is just so important for its credibility, if nothing else. So I support what she's trying to do here.
Fairleigh's over. Senate file 2565 for as amended for possible inclusion.
Senator Bach, Senate File 2872.
Mr. Chairman, there is a small amendment, clarifying amendment, the A1 that I'd like to move.
Senator Bach moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted.
Mr. Chairman, under current law, when auto repair businesses purchase paint and shop supplies, they pay the sales tax on that. And then when they perform work on a vehicle, when they itemize on the invoice to the customer the amount of money that was part of the repair costs that are attributable to paint and shop supplies, it is then tax exempt to the customer. And this reminds me a lot of when we exempted dry cleaning inputs in the dry cleaning process. It's kind of a similar issue. So what the bill proposes to do is to not tax the paint and shop supplies at when the business purchases them, but when the customer is charged on their invoice for the paint and shop supplies, that they would be then taxed at the retail level to the customer. And it does raise a small amount of money. You wouldn't think it would raise money, but it raises some money because those paint and shop supplies actually end up being marked up by the business when they're then resold to the customer. So because instead of being taxed really kind of at the wholesale level that the business purchases it at, those supplies are being taxed at the retail level when they go out to the customer. So it raises a small amount of money. But it seems like a reasonable tax policy to have. And so I bring it to the committee for our consideration. I don't know. Nobody has talked to me about any opposition to it. But I think it makes it a little bit more transparent.
Let's hear from Mr. Wally.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Kevin Wally. I represent the Alliance of Automotive Service Providers, which is the state trade association for independently owned mechanical and collision repair shops. The Department of Revenue and the repair industry have been discussing this issue back and forth for several years. The repair industry supports having sales tax on paint and supplies imposed at the retail level, as Senator Bach has described. Since the 1990s, the department has taken the position that the industry's formula approach, which is used to invoice for paint and supplies, doesn't provide sufficient itemization in order to allow those supplies to be exempt at the wholesale level and have the sales tax imposed at the retail level, as this bill would do. In our discussions with the department, we've pointed out that over 70% of the value of paint and supplies transfers to the vehicle, and it's that issue of transferring to the vehicle at retail, which has been the barrier to this particular tax treatment. We've asked the department whether they could change their interpretation based on that valuation issue, and they've indicated that they would need and would want to have specific statutory authority to do what is proposed in this piece of legislation, and so the bill has come forward. We have had some conversation with folks at the department about the formula method that's used, and they have asked whether we would have some more dialogue with them before this becomes final, just to make sure that they're clearly understanding how that formula works and we have no problem with that whatsoever. So we think this is a way that it will ensure that that tax burden is carried by those who actually receive the benefit of the product. And Senator, so we support this mechanism.
Senator Artman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bach, if you change the place in the transactions where the tax is paid, ordinarily those taxes get paid by the consumer, so they're paying a higher level of tax because the tax is no longer assigned at their wholesale level. It's being assigned at the retail level. I'm not saying it's necessarily a bad thing, but I'm trying to understand what the impact is, and it does mean that those people that pay for paint and other work on their cars pay a little bit higher or more in tax, and that's the difference in what you're raising here.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator, they do or their insurance company does. That's correct.
Well, the consumer ultimately pays regardless.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bach, it makes total sense because that's how an oil change transaction is paid, at the point of sale versus at the other end. So this just makes sense.
Any other questions, members? Anybody in the audience want to speak in opposition to Senate File 2872?
So,
Senator Dibble.
I think Senator Artman cleared up my question, but I just want to be sure I got it right. Is the revenue note reflects the fact that the tax is being paid on the retail price versus the wholesale price?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, right. That's
so
right.
It's being paid on a higher cost. Thank you.
Anything else? Chair lays Senate File 2872 over for possible.
As amended.
As amended for possible inclusion. And meet tomorrow morning, 8. Oops.
Well, maybe I'll just say it from here. Members, we're in the second week of April starting tomorrow. We've got quite a few bills scheduled tomorrow. We're going to hear bills early next week. And then I've been having a conversation with Senator Pogemiller, who's talking to the House about when we might actually bring an omnibus tax bill to the floor. I did introduce the companion to the Lincheski omnibus tax bill. She actually put one together that has the department articles in it and some other things that she's proposing be included in an omnibus bill. I didn't have any input in what's in there. She just sent me the green jackets, and I haven't actually even looked at it yet to see what's all incorporated in there. But that will be the omnibus tax bill vehicle. We've got quite a few members' provisions that I'd like to be able to get into law before adjournment. So my hope is if you could remind our colleagues that if you expect to have a bill, I think, considered for inclusion in the omnibus tax bill, it might have a good idea if it had a bill number by next Monday. That would give people enough time, I think, the next day or two to get something drafted so that it could be available for introduction on Monday. And then we could finalize the hearings on the bills next week and start putting a committee bill together.
Tomorrow morning, 8:30?
Tomorrow morning, 8:30.
Meeting's adjourned.